Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Julian Hayes II, and I'm here with someone who is definitely embodying the superhuman mentality. She has an awesome shirt on that says unbreakable, and there couldn't be a better word to describe her than unbreakable. Normally, I read an introduction of the person, but she has such a fascinating story that I'm going to leave that a mystery, and we're just going to immediately dive into it. So without further ado, I am here with the owner of Posh Notions, Bonnie Hewitt. How's it going?
It's great. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Excited to talk with you.
Yeah, I'm excited as well. You know, I watched your episode on David Meltzer's 2-Minute Drill, and I looked into your backstory, and I was like, oh my goodness, like if something could go wrong during a certain time period, it seemed like it did, but you just kept going. So before we even dive into that, I'm curious, where did you kind of get that mentality from? Was it something from childhood?
No, I think I earned it, honestly. Mm-hmm. That sounds kind of funny to say, but trauma for me started in childhood and kind of different things happened. And I think I was just always in the headspace of like, what other option do I have? Like, you just have to keep taking the next step to keep going. Even if I didn't know where I was going, it was like, you know, I had kids young, so I was doing things for my kids. I just had to be there and keep moving. But I don't think it was something implanted specifically by a person or a mentor or anything. It was just kind of how I live life.
Okay. And so let's dive into that. You were living a pretty typical life. You were an accountant, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was an accountant. So I went, I did university for a couple of years before I had my first child at 21. And then I tried to go back to school. And then finally I did an accounting, not because I liked it or I thought that it would be fun, but because I knew I would be good at it. And it was a quick 2-year degree. And I knew I was going to make more money than I was making minimum wage way back then. I think it was still like $4 an hour or something. So, yeah.
And then I think it was 2011, right? Is that when the health?
That's when I got sick. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in 2011, I was a single mom. I was raising, my oldest is on the autism spectrum. He has Asperger's, and he was 11 and my daughter was 9. And so I was, that summer I was working from home because I didn't have access to childcare. And so I was working as an accountant, trying to do people's bookkeeping, trying to keep my 11-year-old out of trouble, trying to keep my daughter, you know, she was pretty self-sufficient and occupied herself a lot, but they still, you know, how brothers and sisters are, excuse me. And one day while I was waiting for, we had some services for my son coming to the house. I was having chest pain and it was like, I had just started an antibiotic. So I thought maybe I'm allergic to everything else. Maybe I'm allergic to antibiotics. I take some Benadryl, I take some Motrin. I'm like, I need to at least get his session and then I'll call, see if I need to get checked out. I just barely made it through his session with his therapist, I think it was. And called their dad, and I was like, I need to go to the hospital. I'll meet you at the emergency room. I don't know what's going on. I figure it's just allergic reaction. I didn't actually make it there. I had to call an ambulance, and I say passed out, but that's because it appeared that I was unconscious to everybody. It was the most bizarre thing that ever happened to me. So I could feel and hear everything, but I couldn't respond or move. So I was basically paralyzed. And once I got into the hospital and they checked me out after a couple of days, they told me that I had something called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a rare syndrome that attacks the nervous system and the immune system. And I kind of describe it to people as a circuit breaker or a surge protector, where I was just trying to do too much by myself, kind of in the wrong ways. I was pumping caffeine. I wasn't eating right. I was down to like 112 pounds. And just to give you reference, I'm like 5'9". So really thin for me. So I wasn't taking care of my body. And my body was just like, look, we've been trying to give you all these subtle hints, and you're not taking them. So that's it. Like, cause if you keep going this direction, I probably would die. Like, I don't think I would have made it too much longer going how I was going. It paralyzed me, left me in the hospital for a few weeks. It was like having a stroke. So I had to learn to eat and walk and talk all over again. It was interesting. Like, I don't know how else to describe. It was terrifying at some points. But I remember being in there and being very determined to get out of the hospital. Like, I had no intention on staying any longer than I absolutely had to. So back to your question about, how did I get this mindset? I was always sort of more of a watch me person. Like, somebody said, you can't do that. And I'm like, watch me, hold my beer. Mm-hmm. Watch the beer. It was the very beginning of what I call my healing journey. And it was definitely, I would love to say it was a wake up call to all of the stuff that I was doing wrong, but it really wasn't. And I was kept kind of trying to go back to my old life because I had everything stripped away in a matter of moments, like my career. I couldn't work my job. I kept trying, came home the next day and was like trying to do my job. It wasn't working out. I had a lot of cognitive damage. I couldn't learn new things. My short-term memory was shot. So it was definitely an experience. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, those kind of things are hard to put into words.
They are.
It's really hard to just put into words because it's an unreal experience. It's almost probably like you can't believe what just happened.
Yeah. And I wanted to forget that it happened. I wanted to just keep going and go back to what I was doing because, I had bills to pay, I had kids to take care of. And it was what I was used to doing was pushing through stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I said, many traumatic experiences up before that happened. And I was used to just plowing through. Like, that was just kind of how I dealt with things.
How was raising your kids during that time period? I'm sure that was an adjustment, wasn't it?
After coming home, yeah. So my husband and I had split up several years before that and had just agreed to reconcile right before I went into the hospital. So that was interesting in and of itself. When I came home, he ended up going to Texas to pursue a job down there because I wasn't really able to work. And it was interesting. I mean, to put some things into perspective, I was crawling up my steps to use the bathroom. Like, I couldn't walk properly. I spent the majority of my time on a couch, which I hated because I'm not a sit still kind of person. And I was really lucky that my kids were the ages that they were at that time. Cause it was a terrifying experience for them. The kids had to ride with me in the hospital. Like, it was terrifying. When I came home, they really did step it up because I couldn't even lift like a pot of water to boil water. Like, it was things like that that we take for granted every day. And so they were eating a lot of raviolis. They were learning how to cook, basic things, and did a really good job. It was definitely interesting. I have to say I was very lucky that they were at the age where they could walk to the bus stop and home alone without my assistance, because I'm not quite sure. I'm sure it would have worked out, but I'm not quite sure how it would have worked out, up in that age.
Yes. So you mentioned that this wasn't exactly the wake-up call towards your healing journey. And so I'm guessing that there's another situation or mishap that happened along the way that made you kind of relapse.
Actually, you're exactly right. So I ended up being told by doctors after, like, they didn't know what was wrong with me. One doctor said I didn't have Guillain-Barré. All the doctors were like, well, you couldn't have possibly had it, because I ended up in the first 2 months overcoming so much that they were like, there's no way you could have had this because you wouldn't be this far along, kind of thing. I didn't realize that till about 6 years later. But so I wasn't being treated for Guillain-Barré or aftercare for Guillain-Barré, which I should have been. And I ended up at a rheumatologist and a neurologist and a bunch of other doctors, and they're trying to kind of figure out what was going on. And they were like, the outlook just wasn't good. They're like, you're going to live with this for the rest of your life. I had horrible pain. I ended up being diagnosed with fibromyalgia. And then about a year after my husband and I reconciled, I got pregnant with our third kid. And that was honestly probably, he was one of my saving graces, because I couldn't do what the doctors were telling me, which was basically lay around and rest as much as possible, which I didn't really want to be doing either. Mm-hmm. Being pregnant, I'm like, I cannot lay around. I have stuff to do, I've prepared, got to get healthy for the baby. So I had him in 2013, and I have just had to state here that I had a lot of mental illness that preceded my Guillain-Barré. I had already been being treated for that. And I think that was a huge contributing factor to what actually ended up happening to me. And I, again, just kept trying to live as normal as possible. But shortly after having my son, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, because the pain just was so intense, swelling, joints, all of this lovely side symptoms and side effects. I tried to start on the healing from that, but I was nursing, so there was very limited what they could do medicine wise. So I put medicine off for about 2 years. And then I started trying medicines, and it just got really bad. I had either allergic or rare reactions, like every single one that they tried to give me. And finally, I was like, okay, just we're gonna do prednisone. And that was it. And all the meanwhile, I'm still taking all of my psych meds. And I'm getting to why this is important. So 2016, I had my fourth child, which is when I got started with making custom apparel, because fourth kid on the way, I'm not working. My husband's trying to hold down the fort. And it's like, I need to do something to at least contribute to our finances. And I was getting better. Like, I was getting used to, anyhow, all of the pain and the fatigue. And I was finding workarounds for some of it. But in 2017, I had a bunch of different, so I broke my ribs. I had surgery all in a matter of a couple of months, not related to each other. But I remember going into my psychiatrist, and I had been so angry, like rage angry, like dishes raging. And like, I quote air quotes here, the dumbest things that really shouldn't make somebody that angry. And I had been going in every 3 months and talking to him, like, hey, this is, I'm angry. I'm having rage. I'm having anxiety. And he's like, oh, you have a history of anxiety. Like, they kept brushing me off. And I'm like, okay. So they switched this med, switched that med. And finally he goes, well, I think it might be from this one medication. I'm not going to name it, because I don't need to give a bad taste for the med itself. It helps lots of people. But I was immediately angry, because I'm like, I've been taking this medicine for 15 years. You've changed everything else. I've been telling you the same problems over and over and over again. And that was never suggested that I should quit. And that day was one of the pivotal moments in my, like I said, my healing journey. I was like, I'm done. I quit. I was like, I am not taking any of these anymore. And over the course of like a month or so, quit over a dozen psych meds and got them all out of my system. And that was that day, learning that you can't always trust the man that you meet 15 minutes every few months. Mm-hmm. Knows best for your body. You need to listen to what your body's telling you. My body was literally screaming for help. And I was listening to them because they're so-called experts, right? And that was when I really took it on. I have some goosebumps, because it was really at that time, a lot of different things happened. I met my now best friend who's into EFT tapping and a lot of holistic therapies and whatnot. So all these things, once I said I quit doing this, mm-hmm. opened this floodgate of information and people and mindset shifts and just, I really do have goosebumps. It was that pivotal. You would think almost dying, right? Like, I wasn't supposed to come out of the hospital. Like, I wasn't supposed to recover. And then I wasn't supposed to recover. All of that, you would think, would be it. But it was the lack of trust I now had in somebody else taking care of me and putting that all back on myself, taking that responsibility back, was the biggest.
Yeah. Well, I think that personal power, taking that personal power, is the number one thing that we can do in any situation, is to take that personal power. So I can believe it. I've heard it a couple times, many times with people when it comes to that, is that the day I made a decision that I'm going to do something different, all of a sudden we start having these different opportunities show up in our world.
Yeah, I agree. And now that you're pointing it out that way, it's now like I'm connecting dots in my head and I'm like, yes. Like I can see where that's happened multiple times in my life, especially the past 3.5 years. I still can't believe it's only been 3.5 years because so much has happened in the past 3.5 years, but you're right. It's with that decision that we make to be accountable, to be responsible for ourselves, to stop blaming, to stop trusting other people's opinions, even if it's a doctor over the way what our bodies are telling us. And I know that's really hard for a lot of people. Like I know I was angry with the doctors when I couldn't get my meds because this was happening or logistics or whatever, because I felt like I was so dependent on them, thinking like I can't live without this stuff. That day was so powerful for me because it was like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I don't want to live like this anymore. So you're absolutely correct about that.
Yeah. And I think sometimes anger, frustration, I know people sometimes want to avoid those emotions, but oftentimes they are the best emotions to really getting you to change, is to have those. And, you know, so I commend you with that. So besides the mindset shift, which is very important, what were some other things, I'm curious, that you changed to start to heal?
So I don't think I said to myself, I want to heal, so I'm quitting the meds. It was more like, I don't want to be like this. And then it kind of shifted into like lots of little things were popping up. Like I said, this, my now best friend I met, she was a client of mine. I made her business shirts and she came here the one day and it was the most weird thing. It was like, she was like, I have to give you a hug. And I'm like, okay. And we just hit it off so well, like found out how much we had in common. And she reintroduced me to EFT. I'd heard of it before, but I never seriously paid attention because I was still in the mindset that this stuff's not going to fix me. The meds are going to fix me, right? Mm-hmm. Meds don't fix anything unless you've got like a bacterial infection. They will help you manage your symptoms in most cases, but they're not like a quote unquote cure in most cases. And so I'm trying to think what else happened 2017 later. So I said I broke my rib. So I was kind of not on bed rest, but minimal. That was like Thanksgiving-ish. So I was on minimal movement for a little while and I accidentally stumbled on a Tony Robbins video, which then turned into Gary Vee. And then like, I just kind of tumbled into all of these different things that I hadn't really, like, I didn't even know existed, right? Like I knew of entrepreneurs and businesses and things, but I didn't realize these cultures like existed outside of, because I wasn't really a big YouTube person. I know that sounds crazy, but I wasn't. And all of a sudden now I am, because I'm soaking up as much as I can information. And I'm like sitting with a notebook and nursing my baby and writing notes in this. And he's sleeping for 3 hours. So I'm writing more notes, video after video. And so there was a lot of that. And it was a lot of, I guess, knowledge consumption for several months. I was just trying to soak up as much as I possibly could between, you know, positive impact and health and wellness and alternative healing methods. I started doing a little bit of research about supplements, but that part actually kind of came later. Nutrition was one thing. My fourth son had a milk allergy. And that was about the time that I found out how bad dairy really was for my conditions. And it's inflammatory and it causes all kinds of pain. Same thing with sugar. So all these different things were kind of coming out one at a time that I probably had heard before, but either didn't believe or wasn't ready to hear, or kind of a combination of both. Like a lot of people I deal with now, like talk to now, how could sugar be bad for you? How could sugar, you know, cause that much damage? And it's like, just stop eating it for a month and tell me how you feel. And if you don't feel better, then okay, maybe that's not, you know, maybe you don't have a sensitivity to that. Usually that's not the case. But I'm trying to think what else. 2018, I met Gary Vee. I took on a whim as a joke, kind of in a Twitter conversation. He was doing book signing. Do you know who Gary Vaynerchuk is?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. So this was one of those things. I hadn't been anywhere. I had very far by myself in a car ever. And all of a sudden on a whim, I'm driving to New Jersey. Now, to give you reference, I'm in Pittsburgh. So it's like an 8 or 9 hour drive. I'm like, I'm going to go to this and I'm going to get my book signed. And like it literally went Thursday and we left Friday. And that's not how I operate. Like I was very much a plan, like had a list of everything that was going to get packed a week in advance. Like it was like, no, we threw stuff in a bag, got in my truck. My two older kids came with me and we drove to New Jersey. Not only did we drive to New Jersey and met him, we then got on a train, which I had never done, and went to New York City. So me and two teenagers in New York City for the day. Like, and now thinking about it, it sounds ludicrous, but it was it showed me really kind of what I was capable of when I listened to my gut versus overthinking something over and over and over again. And it, that whole trip was amazing. Meeting Gary was amazing. But the whole trip in and of itself was just an amazing thing. It was only like 2 or 3 days long. Like we weren't gone very long. It was just so exciting and getting over a lot of the fears that I had, you know, all in one weekend.
Yeah. Oftentimes our limitations are only set by the thoughts we have. So we're only limited by the thoughts we have. And so that's a huge break point that you just had right there by doing that. And I'm sure that just opened up a whole new world for you.
It did. It was almost kind of like, so I was on this high for a while of, mm-hmm. But we come back to life, come back to your kid raising and come back to all of these different things, come back to the fact that I still have to manage my illness. And later in 2018, I had another somewhat pivotal experience where I had been told that arthritis, I have rheumatoid arthritis, that had moved into my spine. I'd been having a lot of spine pain. So from the time I met Gary, like all the way to, I think it was like September, couldn't get rid of the spine pain. And they did tell me that it was in my spine. And so I went in my doctor literally bawling my eyes out, because here we are back at this place that where your only option is basically to take more meds. And I'm like, I've been minimal meds up to this point because that's kind of how I wanted it. But I agreed, I wanted to stop the progression because my youngest two were only, I think, 2 and 5 at the time. And I'm like, I need my spine. I want to be able to do stuff with them and not limited mode, you know. And so they suggested something called Humira, which is a biologic injectable, which I'm terrified of needles. But I had to agree to, I should say, inject myself with this medication every 2 weeks for, it was about 7 months. And it was probably the most horrible experience I've ever had with medication ever. And I got into some debates with my doctor over getting off of the medication. But it was interesting because in 2019, I then met Evan Carmichael here in Pittsburgh. So that was another big thing that happened. And shortly after that, realized that I had given my power yet away again to this medication and started doing lots of research about supplements, diet. Again, more serious about what I was putting in my body and then how, you know, what quantities, and really started testing things. And I remember talking to the nurse and I said, I want to try these supplements and this and that. And they were so snarky with me. Your doctor said, try whatever supplements you want to try. I'm like, okay, well, I'm just letting you know, I'm not taking this medication anymore. You know what I mean? Like I can't do it. I tried to tell her it was causing me to have anxiety. And if you've had a history of anxiety for 25, 30 years, anytime you tell somebody there's an elevation in your anxiety, it can't be the meds, right? It has to be something you're doing wrong. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. It's like only every 2 weekends when I take this. And anyways, that started another part of my journey where I, again, was listening to my body and said, I'm not going to take any of these things ever again, unless there's a life or death kind of situation where that's what I have, you know, my only option. And I really went hard with the supplements and being careful about what I eat and really reading labels more than I had been. And also really focusing on what I was feeding my mind. That's a huge part that people, I think a lot of people miss when they're doing this, is that they do the body part, which is great, but they don't fix the actual inside stuff.
Absolutely.
So having trouble with anxiety and depression and all of these other things, because they're not also at the same time working on, are they listening to the news all the time? Are all of their friends negative? Are they, you know, what kinds of media are they consuming? So even on social media, like who are your social media people that you follow? And I started cutting away all of those things. And actually a lot of it fell away kind of naturally. When I kind of decided to change who I was and who I was hanging out with, and the way I was talking and what I was interested in, a lot of people fell out of my life naturally because they couldn't, they weren't on, I don't want to say the same level, but they weren't interested in what I was talking about was kind of weird to them. And like, they didn't get it or they didn't believe it. You know what I mean? Like there were so many different reasons, but ultimately it was a really good thing. Was about the time I met David Meltzer. So segue kind of into that.
Yeah. That was going to be the next thing that I was going to ask is that, you know, you're healing your body, you're taking care of a family, and you have a business now that has kind of grown out of a little bit of necessity and then also of looking at the world and looking at opportunity and being smart enough to take advantage of that and to feel a need.
Yeah, I am. So I think you're talking about the business idea that I pitched to David. So to kind of lead into that, I met David. I had read about him, heard about him again, where I said, I've heard, you know, you hear something two or three times and sometimes you don't pay attention to it. And I think he was in Evan's book that I had read. But regardless, sometime in like in the summer of 2019, I found him on Instagram Live. And I was running something I had called, was calling the Unbreakable Campaign, hence the shirt, where I was basically trying to collect stories from people who had overcome trauma or were thriving after chronic illness diagnoses, and get them on video and kind of create like a video bank, if you will, online, so that people who were just in those beginning stages of had just experienced trauma or had just been diagnosed with a chronic illness and really felt like my life is over because I know what that feels like, would have a place to kind of go to help them, either give them a roadmap or give them ideas or just to show them that like you can still live your life. It's just gonna, you're gonna have to make some adjustments. And so my initial, I was trying to ask David, like, how do I get this off the ground? I was struggling to get, to figure out how to get it out there kind of to the public. And it was about maybe 2 months later when we finally actually connected. And then he came here to Pittsburgh, right? And I got to meet him in person. And it was right around the same time I started mentoring with him. He agreed to mentor me. And I remember our very first call was, I was like, I want to do this with the campaign and this, and I'm running this business and I'm trying to figure out how to scale a business by myself and all these different things. And he basically says to me, you're not going to do anything until you get your health in check.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, that was not the advice I was looking for, you know, but really it was the advice that I needed, because it honestly took me 8 or 9 months after quitting the Humira that March,
mm-hmm.
get it completely out of my system and get back to what I would call my baseline. So I still wasn't quite well, but I was still so ambitious trying to help all these other people. And he basically is like, you need to fill your own cup first. Or you're not going to make it very far. And it was hard. I want to say it was hard to accept, but because I felt so, thought so much of him, I kind of mm-hmm. had him like a pedestal almost. I was like, this man took his time to talk to me and he's 3,000 miles away. And this is what he's sensing. There's got to be a reason he's telling me, so I'm going to listen. And then we really kind of hashed out some practical tips. And there was a lot of metaphysical, I guess is the right word, stuff too, like meditation. And I had a lot of, generational trauma that I guess mm-hmm. I was carrying with me. I'm a very empathetic, carrying type of person. And I didn't realize how this stuff was affecting me until I released it all. And so I kept working with him, and it was sometime in March of 2020. Actually in January 2020, I told him I'm going back to basics and I'm stripping my life of everything completely unnecessary, because I realized how much I was doing that I didn't need to be doing. It was really bogging me down, causing burnout and all kinds of issues. And in March, I was finally felt like I was actually ready. And he finally agreed that like I was actually ready to kind of like tackle a business. Yeah. And just to start helping with that, I also started flipping stuff on eBay. It's kind of, he always talks about the legs feed the line. You know, you need to have something that's constantly bringing in income while you're figuring out your other stuff. And COVID hit. It hit us all. And what I was doing at the time was making logo gear, which is what I'm doing now again, but making logo gear, which is basically promotional wear for small businesses, organizations, like stuff you see now. This is Rhinestone. It's not typical, but it's something else I do. There was no demand for that, especially not somebody as small as myself. So it was a couple of weeks in. We got shut down here in the middle of March. I know everybody's areas were a little bit different. But it was right smack in the middle of March here. And a couple of weeks later, I had people coming to me, and two people come and say, I want you to make custom masks. And I was like, no, I don't sew. I have not the first clue of how to sew. And the third person comes and I'm like, oh. So I believe in the law of three. I'm like, I've got to figure this out. I've at least got to make an attempt, right? Like there's some reason people keep coming and asking me if I can do this. And custom masks sound like a really great idea. So of course I reach out to David and I'm like, hey, I'm like, I don't know how to sew. I have this vintage sewing machine in my garage that's buried somewhere. I'm going to pull it out. Do you think this is something that I could possibly, you know, make work? And he was like, absolutely. And that's what I love about him is when I hit it on something, it's either like a no, like he told me that first time, or absolutely. There's kind of no maybes or in-betweens with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very certain about his answers. And so I pull out this 6-year-old sewing machine, right? And I've got two videos up of me trying to plug it in and like, does it have power and does it work? Ultimately, it ended up being broken. So I borrowed one from my friend that I was talking about earlier, and it was also broken. In a matter of like a week and a half, 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, I had opened my Etsy shop with 5 masks. So I learned how to sew. Learned how to make masks and had quality products. Cause I'm one of those people, like if I can't yank on, you know, like if it's not quality, I'm not putting my name on it. Like I'm
right.
Have those perfection tendencies, which actually work out sometimes. And in this case, it was good. So it went great for a while. The demand was really high. I was making custom for different companies. And really my initial idea was I wanted to sell enough to be able to send masks to other high-risk people like myself. Basically, I wanted to donate them. And I did get to do a little bit of that. But I ended up making, did not stop in that mask. I learned how to make pillows and I was making skirts and I was making all, every time I thought of something, I was like, I want to try to make that. Some of it was a disaster. Some of it was really cool and ended up in my Etsy shop. But the one thing that started almost from the beginning was the lack of supplies and materials and the inability to get materials. One, because of shipping. Two, because people were gouging the prices on materials. So I tell people to, for reference, like a foot of elastic costs like 10 cents and they were charging like $4 a foot for that same piece of elastic. Oh yeah, it was terrible. And you need two pieces to make earbands or masks. So if you can imagine, like, so after talking to my mom, I started cleaning up people's basements basically with her help because I'm in quarantine. I literally haven't been anywhere but my daughter's graduation since last year. Mm-hmm. She felt comfortable going and collecting people's old vintage fabrics. So all these boxes start coming in and box after box of vintage fabrics. And I like instantly fell in love with not only the fabrics themselves, but this idea of taking something that was being unused and was never gonna be used probably and turning it into something completely usable. And it was around August when I said to David, I was like, I would really love to build an upcycling company. And briefly explain kind of like what that is. And it's basically taking something and recycling it in a way that makes it better. So there's lots of different ways to do that. And I've also tested lots of different materials. And I said, is this something that's scalable? And he said, yes. And I said, okay, well, that's really cool. And then I kind of just sat there because like, I was still sewing and whatnot, but the idea just kind of sat because I'm like, I don't know the first thing about trying to build something like this. Like there was a lot more involved with the idea and what I wanted to do. And being in quarantine put a huge kind of, I'm going to say blockage, at least temporarily on that. And then I'm trying to think, so that's August. October, he starts, I'm not sure when he started 2 Minute Drill on YouTube. They have been doing like pitch competitions on YouTube. And I honestly didn't really pay much attention to them because I'm like, I don't belong here. I don't have these sales numbers. I don't have their PowerPoint slides. Like I total impact. Like, no, I had no, never in a million years thought that I should be pitching a business idea because I didn't have what it takes. Right. That's what I, in my head, I'm telling myself, at least not yet. And some point in I think October, they decided to take the show to TV and we start hearing about it more and more in private group. And I start asking kind of questions and, you know, do you think this is something I should think about doing? Oh, absolutely. Okay. Well, you know, and then next week I would ask different questions. Like, what do I need for a pitch? Or what do I, like, I had no idea how to do something like this at all. It wasn't in my, you know, reference realm. No, none of my friends are involved in nothing. And I was kind of like hinting about, but I never seriously thought I was going to actually do it. It was more like just kind of sticking my toes in and testing the water and trying to learn as much as I could. And that was definitely not one of those things where I made a quick decision and jumped. It was like, I'm going to do this. It wasn't until mid-November, I think, in one of the private coaching groups. And after I continued to ask questions about how to write a pitch. And he was telling everybody, you know, if you haven't signed up for the pitch competition, make sure you sign up. And he was, that means you, Bonnie, like in front of the entire group, right? Calls me in front of everybody. And I'm like, now I have to do it. Now I have to at least attempt to do this, right? I still waited 3 more days to fill out the application because I was terrified. I'm like, I don't belong here. There's nothing telling me that this is a good idea except for David, right? So I literally was hanging on his word. Him calling me out, and I'm like, you have so much more faith in my ability to do this right now than I do. I'm gonna hang on to that. And sometimes I think that that's really what a coach is there for, is to believe in you more than yourself until you then believe in yourself as much as kind of they do. And he's definitely done that for me on a couple of different occasions. So yeah, that's how I got, that was a lot, but that's how I got up to that, to the point of applying for this show. So I don't know if you have any questions.
Do you still have imposter syndrome?
I do. Yeah. I don't think, to be honest with you, like that, the whole thing, the whole experience was very surreal. And I don't think imposter syndrome just goes away.
No, it doesn't. I can agree.
At driving through the fear, like I said, or ignoring it, or just doing things anyways, mm-hmm. which is kind of what I did that whole next, 2-3 weeks, until I actually, you know, went live. So it was a crazy experience. The whole thing was a crazy experience.
And so as you did your pitch, and were you nervous when you were getting your pitch ready?
I didn't have the first idea of what I was supposed to put on a piece of paper, because everything, like I said, I listened to was sales figures and revenue numbers and market share. And I'm like, I don't even know what some of this stuff means. like the basics I did, obviously, but like they're talking venture capitalism. I wasn't in that world. You know, I had never been in that world. And so I'm like, I don't know how to do this. So I did research, and I got, David actually has a pitch, a training guide. He has training guides on like lots of things. So I pulled a training guide, and I literally followed point by point. There's 5 points on there, the best that I absolutely could. And my first pitch was like 870 some words. Now, mind you, you've got 2 minutes.
Yes. So
nearly three times the length it needed to be. And I spent the next 3 weeks paring down, adding, taking things out. And I wasn't really scared writing the pitch, nervous writing the pitch. It was more, how do I make this the best possible that it can be? Because like, I didn't want to embarrass myself, obviously. I didn't want to embarrass him, because he's encouraging me to do this and has faith that I can do it. And at the very least, I just need to pitch, give my very best pitch. And I managed to get it down to, you know, as I think 375 words or something like that. I'm looking up here because I still have it hanging on my mirror in my bedroom. So I got the final copy. I recorded myself like 400 times giving this pitch, 400 recordings on my phone.
Wow.
Yeah. I was dead serious about not screwing up at the very least. Like, even if my pitch didn't fit, like I was going to make sure that I delivered it the best that I could. And it was funny because when I submitted the application, they ask you for a mini pitch. I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to write in here. And all of a sudden it just kind of came to me, and I wrote my mini pitch. And the same with my target audience. I'm like, I don't know. I've been trying to figure out my target audience for like 6 months, and in 5 seconds, it just like came to me. Right. Like last minute, it was crazy. And like you were saying, opportunities come when you make that decision to do it. So when I made the decision to fill out the application, not thinking I'm going to get picked, right? I'm going to do what I say I was going to do. And stuff starts coming to me. And I remember getting the email, and I'm running around screaming, and I'm trying to explain to people what I'm doing. And I'm telling my friends, and like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, there's this thing. I'm going to be on TV, okay? That's all you need to know, is I'm going to be on TV telling them about what I want to do with my business. And I will let you know when it's time to watch. And so I kind of put all of that excitement into what I was pitching, and I really pitched myself. The one thing that David talks about, and I've heard other people say, is that people buy from people. And although the sales numbers and all of that stuff is important, later on down the road, when you have just an idea that you're trying to kind of manifest, they want to know how you as a person are going to kind of make this work. So the numbers aren't always the most important thing. And I structured my pitch in such a way that it showed, I talked a little bit about what I had been through and kept going. Like you said in the beginning, I kept going. And that to them was more important than not having the sales figures, not having, you know, the revenue and interest or NFL sponsors or any of the other stuff that a lot of these other people had. So yeah, the day of, even you were saying about keep going, the day of was even interesting. We had no power. Our power went out the morning I was supposed to record. And yeah. And we were back like 30 minutes before I'm supposed to go on. And I'm still running around like trying to get a shower. I'm telling this kid to do this and that kid to do that, and finally get power back on. And we have no internet. I couldn't get my computer to do what it needed to do. And I called my oldest son. He's like the computer guy. I'm like, can you fix this? I was like, I need to finish getting ready. I have 5 minutes before I'm supposed to go on. And everything literally came together and I logged in like on the dot.
Wow.
And like I said, the whole thing was like terrifying. It was exhilarating. I also didn't have a lot of time to think. Like I was almost in panic mode, but not in panic mode, like a calm panic mode where I just was like, keep moving. And eventually everything's either going to come together or it's not. And I'm going to either go on or I'm not. Like there's only two options really here. It's either going to happen or isn't.
Right.
So yeah, it was pretty confusing.
And the thing that stood out to me the most was, I guess two things. One, like you mentioned, is that you pitched yourself really. First and foremost, you pitched yourself your story, and there's a personal connection to it, and you could tell the passion behind it. And two, you also showed that you didn't have an ego, because I think they asked you about sales and marketing, you're like, yeah, I'm going to look at someone to do that because I don't really know how to do that stuff.
Yeah, that question totally caught me off guard because I wasn't expecting to be asked a question like that. And yeah, so I definitely was like, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh crap. I'm like, I lost. Like literally in my mind, listening to everybody else pitch. Again, I'm still in imposter mode because I'm like, this guy's got NFL sponsors. And so you watched the episode, you saw like all these, I'm going, how do I compete with that?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to compete. Like, I'm not going to give up because I'm already here. But in my mind, I'm like, how do I compete with that? But what was funny is I started listening to the feedback. Mm-hmm. The judges were giving each of the contestants. I'm like, okay, like that's not stuff. This is why I'm not judging the show, because I thought everybody pitched fantastic and nobody messed up anything. Right. And they get to me and I didn't have any negative feedback. And I know that sounds almost egotistical, but it's facts. Like if you watch the show, mm-hmm. it's negative feedback. And after I came off the screen and the last couple was pitching, I was like, wait a minute. I'm listening to their pitch and I'm like, okay, I'm still kind of nervous, but I don't know if you love swearing on your show or not, but
you can swear. You can swear. There's no language.
My phone was recording the whole thing. Cause I'm like, I'm going to capture all of this for myself. And I literally, it's still just for myself. I turned on my camera. I'm like, I fucking won. Mm-hmm. In my head, I'm trying to also manifest, right? I've got, you fucking got this on my mirror. Just breathe on my mirror. There was another one. Oh, this one that says we have back. Sign the universe. Like I've got all this stuff.
Yeah.
We're talking about feeding my mind as I'm trying not to sweat to death. And I listened to their pitch and it was like, it was still great. But when I heard their feedback, I was like, I think I got this. Like, and then I'm going, oh my God, like I wasn't going to do this. And then I didn't think I could do this. And then like, I got, and they tell you a lot of it's waiting around. It's like 3.5 hours of waiting around and listening to other people or whatnot. But the producer comes on and goes after everybody pitches and he says, now they're going to pick the winner and only the winner is going to show up on the screen at this last thing. So if you see your face on the screen, you won. If you didn't, hold on. We have some follow-up questions to ask you. Mm-hmm. I'm standing there for like 20 minutes, like forever. And I see my face pop up on the screen. And I don't think you could tell because of the lighting, but mm-hmm. my face was like on fire, bright red. I'm trying not to tear up. And David's tearing up, like talking and tearing up as you saw. And I didn't know what to say, but thank you. Like I was so beside myself and I literally felt like I went into like an alternate reality for a while. Mm-hmm. Because my family's downstairs waiting for me to come down and tell them what happened. And I can't go anywhere for like another hour and a half. So I'm just standing here pacing and this excitedness trying to stay quiet. And what's funny, I didn't mention, so you saw the video was kind of, pixelated. I was forgetting that word. They came on after I gave my pitch and I'm like breathing and they're like, we need you to record again. I'm like, what? Your video was choppy. We need you to record again. I'm like, okay. So I give the pitch like 3 more times just to the producer, just so they can catch the video and the audio correctly. And finally I was like, what, can I just record this and send it to you? Because like, I can't do this again. Like I'm just, you don't know anything at this point. And I'm like, I can't, my adrenaline was pumping so hard at that point. I can't do any more adrenaline. I was like, I got to stop. And, but yeah, it was, again, the video cutting out was another like, no. So it was like, no, 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 no. Hey, you won. Like what? It was insane. It was so insane in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very surreal.
Yeah. You know, like, you know, watching that episode, and I will share that in the notes and everything for listeners and viewers as well to check out as well. But, you know, it just reminded me, as you know, that people do invest in people, and it's good to have soul. So you had soul, like you can feel the pulse in what you were doing. It's not just a lot of this other stuff where the accolades and all that, it's good. Yes. That's awesome to see, but it's still kind of surface level metrics that you can work your way to get that, but you can't really necessarily at times work with getting a pulse if you don't actually have like the soul and pulse and really the passion for the business.
Yeah, I agree with that. And in hindsight, I can see exactly like I agree with you, and I can see kind of where, I'm not saying that these people don't, but they're not exuding that. And I remember one of the questions I asked David at one point, I was like, I just got the list of contestants. Should I go check out what they're doing? And he specifically told me, he's like, I've seen billionaires that can't pitch for shit, and people who have never done quote unquote, like anything business related, can pitch your pants off and convince you to, you know, invest $2 million in them right off the spot, just because they're that good. They're that good. Their story, they have, like you said, the passion and the drive and everything else. And it just made me realize, and I'm still struggling again with imposter syndrome, but it did make me realize that also sometimes people, like, I'm an underdog. Like, I haven't built $1 million businesses, I haven't done all of this other stuff. I'm one of the most on the surface unlikely people to build a multi-billion-dollar company. Yet that's where I'm setting my eyeballs right now.
I love it.
Because I know that multi-billion is, you know, the more people I can help. It's still daunting to me, and I know I have to take it one step at a time, but I'm still feeling the same way, which is, what is the alternative? The same way I operated with my health is like, I'm 42. I had to think about it for a second. 42. And like, my youngest is 4 years old. Am I really going to sit around for the next 14 years waiting for him to turn to an adult doing what? Like, I need to do something, you know, and what's better than trying to build a business in order to help other people and the environment and all these different things, excuse me, in the process.
Yeah, I love that. And that's why, like I said, I was glad you showed up with the Unbreakable shirt, because that's you in a nutshell, you know, that's you in a nutshell. And so as we get ready to start winding this episode down and everything, I'm just going to do a few random questions. So what are like two or three books that have really helped you?
Reason people would think, but so Evan Carmichael's Your One Word was a really good book for me. One, it helped me find, like, my one word is spirit, and I also kind of embody that through Unbreakable and the Unbreakable campaign. It's kind of all tied together, and spirit for me is just that never giving up. Slow down, rest if you need to, but never give up. David Meltzer's Connected to Goodness was definitely, that was the first time I had ever read a book that connected business ideas and spirituality and together in the same place. And I was immediately hooked and understood why I felt so connected to him before I even knew him. Mm-hmm. It's because I think he got it. Like, there had been something in business that had been missing all the way up until the point where I read that book. And I really latched on to him and his concepts at that point. Those are probably the biggest two. Mm-hmm. I tend to read in spurts, so like 5-6 books at a time, and then I won't read for like a month or two, vice versa. So in a few more months, I might change my mind.
I, haven't, I, haven't, haven't read neither of those books, so I'm going to have to go check those out.
Yeah, I have a few that are, I'm halfway through. So this is Jim Quick's book. What's his name? Vishen Lakhiani, his last book. I'm like halfway through. And I find that I get stuck where they give you the checklist of questions to answer. And I'm like, I don't know. And I overthink it. So there's three books now. I'm stuck at that point in the book. Total transparency here. I'm like almost looking for the right answer when I should just be giving my first answer. But I'll read through a whole list and I'm not write anything down. Yeah, so that's one of my flaws that I'm working on right now.
I can relate to that sometimes when reading, when there's like exercises or something that they want you to do. And you're like, I just want to read, but I don't want to skip this as well. So I totally get it. I have a book like that now that I haven't picked up in a few days because I'm at the end of chapter one and I'm supposed to do a journaling exercise. So
yeah, I'm in another book. I just started reading David's recommendations called Brag Better, because as I was telling you,
I've never heard of that.
Starting a conversation about myself is not easy. Once somebody starts asking me questions, kind of like you do, I have a hard time shutting up. But starting a conversation about myself is difficult. One of the reasons I'm also doing these podcasts.
I need to check that out myself. So I'm going to check
it out. It has exercises, just for warning you, right? When you said chapter one, I'm going, yeah, I'm in chapter one. But the questions are a lot more, they're introspective, but they're more, they feel more manageable. And I'm hoping that if I do it in that book, then I can go back to the other ones if I can move forward in those books as well.
Right. Okay. And so let's pretend that you have a roundtable discussion and you can have water, you can have tea, you can have smoothies, you can have whatever kind of drink you want there to serve everyone. And you got three available seats there. You can invite any three people from history, dead or alive, but it has to exclude family. Who would you invite?
Family. I think one of them, which is funny because it's just something new, to Thomas Edison, because I think I was just on a different podcast and they were talking about, you know, the 10,000 ways before he figured out how to make the light bulb. And man, that's somebody you really want to have a conversation with. I feel like somebody who's got that type, like I'm tenacious, but that man, I don't know if I could do the same thing 10,000 times, you know? And just to really kind of get into his head. Another person would be I'm drawing a blank on his name. Napoleon Hill.
Okay.
Because he talked to so many people to write that book. And I bet he's got some really fascinating stories to tell that didn't make it into the book, per se. And then who else would I want to talk to? Robin Williams. I got goosebumps again. I'm not one to be hit too hard by celebrity, you know, passings. I haven't really felt that connected to somebody for some reason. Like I just loved, he was in my favorite movie probably ever. And I still, even thinking about it makes me want to tear up, because you never know what somebody's dealing with if they're not talking about it. Right. Would have loved to meet him in person.
Okay. And the final question here is, we're going to change it a little bit. We're going to take superhuman out of it. We're going to bring unbreakable into it. So if someone comes up to you today and they tap you on the shoulder and they ask you, Bonnie, what are three things that I can do to become an unbreakable entrepreneur today? What would you recommend?
First would be to do the hard shit. Like you can't become unbreakable without having stuff try to break you. And the stuff that tries to break you is usually the hard stuff. And you're not going to build that kind of unbreakable confidence without showing yourself that you can do hard things. The second, which probably should have been the first, is listen to your body, listen to your instinct, listen to your gut, listen to the things that are hurting or bothering you. Take them seriously. I don't mean heart attack serious, but I mean, take them serious. If it's stuff that keeps recurring, your body's trying to tell you something, your inner spirit, inner self is trying to give you a message about something. And then the third one, don't be afraid to ask a lot of questions.
I like that one.
That's something I struggled with for a really long time after some, traumatic stuff. I was afraid to use my voice, and I'm still learning. Like I use my voice in different ways. But asking questions is one of the first steps into doing that.
I love that. That's a great way to book in the conversation here. You know, I'm putting this out in the universe. I look forward to reading the Unbreakable book in a few years from you. I look forward to reading that in a few years.
Thank you. It's so funny you said that, because that was actually something I was trying to do and put on hold for a while.
Yeah. So yeah, see, I just felt it, you know, so I'll be looking forward to reading that. And but before we get out of here, where can listeners keep up with you more?
So I am Posh Notions across social media, YouTube, so all the main, you know, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. The only place I'm not right now is LinkedIn because I'm locked out of my account. And I don't really hang out on TikTok too much, although I'm rethinking that. So it's PoshNotions. And also my website, my Etsy shop, everything's under Posh Notions. So it's fairly easy to find me.
Okay. And I will have all this in the show notes as well. So once again, Bonnie, thank you so much for joining me. And listeners out there, stay awesome, be limitless, and go be superhuman. Peace.